We're talking about a godly family, trying to help make the family work. Somebody said I must have had a bug in their car, and at first I thought they meant like a spider. But they were talking about an electronic bug because they said the things I talked about last week they had been talking about previously as they were driving along. No, I think they knew that of all people, I wouldn't be the one who would know how to work an electronic bug. So they're safe. But the fact is, a lot of these things we're talking about are things that are our real concerns, and therefore we do talk about them. And that's why they're subjects of perpetual interest that get assigned over and over again. Last week we were talking about motherhood, and we were doing it based on 2 Timothy chapter 1. And I think to get us back into that, because we didn't quite finish it, I'll go ahead and read the first few verses of 2 Timothy chapter 1. Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, by the will of God, according to the promise of life which is in Christ Jesus, to Timothy, my dearly beloved son, grace, mercy, and peace from God the Father and Christ Jesus our Lord. I thank God, whom I serve from my forefathers with pure conscience, that without ceasing I have remembrance of thee in my prayers night and day, greatly desiring to see thee, being mindful of thy tears, that I may be filled with joy, when I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, which dwelt first in thy grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice, and I am persuaded that in thee also. Wherefore I put thee in remembrance, that thou stir up the gift of God which is in thee by the putting out of my hands. For God hath not given us the spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind, meaning self-control. Those are the first seven verses there, and we were applying this to motherhood within the biological home. Even though Paul did not have natural offspring that we know of, he regarded Timothy as his own son in the flesh. He said to the Corinthians, though you have 10,000 instructors in Christ, you have not many fathers, for in Christ Jesus I have begotten you through the gospel. So Paul's relationship to the church, was similar to that of a father with sons and daughters. I don't know what happened. Is it something in the room? I do have allergies from time to time, but this is the first time in months that that's happened, so I don't know. Thanks, Jerry. I know he's getting me some water. What a guy. Anyway, well, there it is back. So I don't know what happened there, and I'm sorry for the disruption. We talked about this, making a few points. We talked about the connection between the grandmother and the mother and the son, how the faith was put into the boy almost by the process of osmosis, and we talked about that quite a little bit. The tenderness of this man, he had tears. Paul remembered and was mindful of the tears of Timothy. Even though Timothy was male, he still had tears, and we talked about that for a while. So the tenderness that comes from a mother and a grandmother, I don't think I need it now, but I appreciate it just as much as if I did. Thank you very much. I always hate to drink in front of an audience because everybody gets thirsty. So here's what I do. Good. Whoever made water knew what he was doing. So we talked about the tenderness that was transmitted from the grandmother to the mother to the son. We talked about the sincere faith, the unfeigned faith, how authentic the faith of Timothy was. Remember, Paul had a lot of lieutenants, apparently evangelists, many or most of them, that he could send out various places. But he said to the Philippians one time regarding Timothy, I have no man like-minded who will naturally care for your state. He had a lot of people working with him and for him, but he didn't have anybody like Timothy. And he's thinking in terms of how Timothy got to be the way he was. And it had a lot to do with the grandmother and the mother. So sincere faith. And we went on from that to talk about Timothy's inner confidence, how he was nurtured in the Holy Scriptures, as we read in 2 Timothy chapter 3, another chapter in this same book. We talked about the love that was transmitted from the grandmother and the mother, and we had just finished talking about that, and I had one more point that I wanted to refer to here in 2 Timothy with regard to the motherhood and what she did for her son. And it has to do with this self-control, the last word in the last verse that I read. God has not given us through our roots a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of self-control. And this may be the acme of a great deal that our mothers do for us. This is self-mastery. It's self-rule. It's self-discipline. God has not given us through our roots a spirit of timidity, but of confidence, of love, and of self-control. In other words, our mothers help us develop the ability to say no when the great majority says yes, the ability to say yes when everybody else is saying no. The mother's goal of helping the child come to know herself or himself begins with those faithful little reproofs. No, no, don't touch that. And then a little slap on the hand if we disobey that. This is so crucially important over time. Way up to the time when they're young people and the mother says, honey, I don't think that's too wise, this thing that you're considering. And ultimately, through this process, the child learns self-control so that when the mother dies, the child's life goes right on. There was a study done a number of years ago of 1,738 middle-class boys and their families, beginning in pre-adolescence and following these boys through young manhood. And the boys who had the higher degree of self-control, of course, were the most successful in every area of life. And in studying these families, it was learned that, and this is quite a sampling, 1,738 families, the boys who had the best self-control were clearly more loved and appreciated at home. They had parents who were significantly more strict in their approach to discipline than the other families. The parents in the group that had low self-control had created insecurity by their permissiveness to these boys. They had created a dependence in the boys that was not outgrown. And their children were more likely to feel that the rules were not enforced because nobody cared enough to enforce them. Also, the homes of the boys with more self-control were characterized by openness. Once the boundaries for behavior were established, there was a freedom for the individual expression of their own personalities to develop and grow, and the boys could express themselves without fear of ridicule in their homes. The overall atmosphere of the successful homes, the more successful homes, was marked by acceptance and emotional safety. And my point here with regard to motherhood is that the mother is key to so much of that. In general, we spend more time with our mothers growing up than we do with our fathers, a great deal more time because of the nature of things. The fathers are out earning a living. So the mothers really are the secret. The mothers are the turnkey. The mothers are the touchstone to so much. Tenderness, authentic faith, confidence, love, self-control. That's what this chapter teaches us about motherhood. There's something about motherhood that gives a perspective and an insight that men just do not have and apparently are not intended to have. There's a 9-month advance that a mother has that a father does not have. The mother feels and knows that child before the child is ever born and before the husband knows that child. You know, some of you know that recently in my extended family, there were a pair of twins born, tiny little things, beautiful little creatures. And I love them, I enjoy being around them and seeing them, but I cannot relate to them in the way a woman does. It's just a fact. I couldn't begin to. My wife, my daughter, and my granddaughter have an affinity for those babies that maybe I'll get something like that later when they're able to get up and walk around and talk to me, but I don't have it when they're at this stage of babyhood. I think this may be a part of God's design. We're just different. Mothers and fathers are different. We are not interchangeable parts. We cannot trade places with each other. We both have a role to do. For the first year of life, the child I started to say he hardly knows who his father is. That's not exactly right, especially toward the end of that first year. But it's the mother that he knows first. It's the mother that he knows best. And I think this is surely God's plan. Mothers seem to know instinctively. That old statement that I've seen on put on with a magnet to 1,000 refrigerators across the country through the years, that if a child lives with criticism, he learns to condemn. If he lives with hostility, he learns to fight. If he lives with ridicule, he learns to be shy. If he lives with shame, he learns to feel guilty. If he lives with tolerance, he learns to be patient. If he lives with encouragement, he learns confidence. If he lives with praise, he learns to appreciate. If he lives with fairness, he learns justice. If he lives with security, he learns to have faith. If he lives with approval, he learns to like himself. If he lives with acceptance and friendship, he learns to find love in the world. There's a lot to that. You may not agree with every point of that, but in general, I think it's a good thing to remind ourselves of. In the 24th chapter of the book of Proverbs, there's a statement made there, and I'm not even going to turn over to it. But it says there that a house is built by wisdom. A house is established through understanding. And by knowledge, the rooms of the house are filled with all precious and pleasant riches. This tenderness, this faith, this confidence, this love, and this self-discipline and self-control come in great part from our mothers. So if you're a mother and you're raising children actively at this time, I hope you'll keep up that good work. There's no substitute for it. Questions, comments, or thoughts about motherhood? Okay, let's talk about fatherhood. Fatherhood is equally important. I couldn't put one above the other. They each have their role, and it's impossible to switch these roles successfully. The fact is that your father has left his indelible mark on your life. It's like a thumbprint. It's his unique print on your life. Now, I was talking with a girl earlier this week who doesn't even know who her father was or is. She doesn't know if he's dead or alive. If she passed him on the street, she wouldn't know it, and he wouldn't know it. But even so, I can guarantee you that father has left his thumbprint on that girl's life. The fact that he's not there says everything to her. If you are a father, you are making unerasable impressions on your children. You had a father, and he made the same kind of impressions on you. Think about your father. Maybe he was reliable and solid. Or maybe he was dreamy and visionary. Maybe he was the creative type. Maybe he was unstable, weak, preoccupied. Maybe he was angry, impatient, even brutal. Maybe he was shiftless, lazy, a deserter of your home. Or maybe he was a man of integrity and dependability and godliness. Maybe he was a workaholic. Maybe he was an alcoholic. Maybe he seemed too young to be a father. Or maybe he seemed old all your life. But he had an impact on you. And the role of a father is a very difficult role to fulfill. I think nobody who hasn't been a father can fully understand that. Fathers live with certain dilemmas. One of them is that it's so very difficult to live up even to their own standards, let alone the standards of God. And they've got a whole bunch of things being juggled in life, like making a living, etc. And they have this responsibility of fatherhood that seems like a full-time job, but they don't have full time to devote to it. So how do you handle all of that? I'd like to go to another one of Paul's epistles to slip into this subject. This is the first epistle to the Thessalonians. And chapter 2 there, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Let me just read the first couple of verses of that to get into it. For yourselves, brethren, know our entrance unto you was not in vain. But even after we had suffered before and were shamefully entreated, as you know, at Philippi, we were bold in our God to speak unto you the gospel of God, which with much contention. Down in verses 5 and 6, he talks about that he could have asserted his authority, but he treated them in a certain way. Verse 5, neither at any time used we flattering words, as you know, nor a cloak of covetousness, God is witness, nor of men sought we glory, neither of you, nor yet others, when we might have been burdensome as the apostles of Christ. I was an apostle of Christ. I could have said that every day and emphasized it, and you would have had certain responsibilities toward me. But I didn't pull rank on you. I treated you differently than that. And that's the point in verses 7 and 11. Verse 7. We were gentle among you, even as a nurse cherisheth her children. The word for nurse is a nourisher, trophos, in the original language. A nurse, we were like, I was like a nursing mother to you in Thessalonica. And then down in verse 11, he says, you know how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father doth his children. So Paul behaved both as a mother and a father to these people, who many of whom were his spiritual children. That's Paul at Thessalonica. I was gentle as a nursing mother. I very well remember the first time I saw my wife nurse our first child. There is no picture anywhere in my brain that is tenderer than seeing that. A nursing mother. This emphasizes the tenderness and care of a mother, as we did last week. And down in verse 11, I charged you as a father doth his children. This is what characterizes a faithful father with his children. If I am an effective father, it's because I have deliberately set out as one of my life's highest priorities the creation of conditions in my home that will stimulate my children to grow to their fullest godly potential. If I am an effective father, it's because I have devoted myself to become an instrument and a model of human experience to my children. If I am an effective father, it's because I have sharpened my sensitivity to my family's needs, I have committed my inner being to God's laws, and I have fixed a foresightful eye on opportunities and hazards ahead, because I want to make sure that every family experience builds my children up and matures them. If I am an effective father, it's because I am filling my children's lives with perspectives and patterns which produce wisdom in them. I am lovingly purging their lives of unwholesome influences and tendencies that impede their progress toward maturity. If I am an effective father, it's because I accept and affirm my children for who they are. I appreciate them for what they are accomplishing, and I cover them with affection because they are mine. If I am an effective father, it's because I'm aware that I always live on the edge of ineffectiveness, and I must continually reach out to God for wisdom and skill to accomplish my task. How was Paul's fatherliness to these people in this congregation at Thessalonica expressed? What does he say about it? First, in verse 8, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 8. So, being affectionately desirous of you. That's the first thing. Being affectionately desirous of you. Now, this is a word that has to do with the idea of love, but this is not agape and it's not philia. Not either one of those usual words for love in the New Testament. Rather, this is a word that's used only one time anywhere in the New Testament, translated here as affectionately desirous in the King James. But it's a special word. It means to desire, to long for, to yearn for. It refers to the longing of love to feel oneself drawn to someone with a strong intensity. It refers to a warm, inward, attachment. The word used here is a term of endearment that's derived from the language of the nursery. I remember the first time I held our first baby. She had just been born, and we were in the delivery room. She just made her entrance into the world. Nurse wrapped her up and put her in my arms, about the size of a cat. And the first thing I had done before she was even wrapped up was count all the fingers and toes, make sure everything was there physically. When she was put in my arms, it was about the weight of a little animal, and I've held lots of cats and dogs through the years. But it was when I got to the eyes that I really noticed the change. Those eyes were different from the eyes of any animal. You know, one way that we are deceived by the propounders of the theories of evolution is that when they draw models of these figures of the ancient apes that we're supposed to be descended from, they put human eyes in them. You ever notice that? Now, we don't have the eyes. We've got skeletons. We've got a few bones. We don't have the eyes, but when they draw what they must have looked like, they'll put human eyes in those creatures. The idea is to show that they're animal, but they're becoming more than animal. When I got to those little tiny baby eyes, suddenly I was looking at human intelligence, and human intelligence was looking back at me. I got the immediate and strong impression that she was sizing me up, like there was scrutiny going on. Like it was as if she was asking, are you ready for this? It was amazing. And I'll never forget that moment. And I remember, I think I may have whispered out loud, I don't know if I'm ready, but I'm going to do my best. Instantly, there was a connection. So helpless, so totally dependent, and yet looking out at the world with intelligence already. So I held her close. I just held her close. Why do we stop doing that? Do our children outgrow the need to be held close like that? Or do they need that fond, warm affection demonstrated and shown physically as they grow? Let me read you something. This is a quotation from an old book. It's called The Effective Father by Gordon MacDonald. This quotation comes from pages 229 and 231. This man is apparently some kind of a counselor or psychologist or something along those lines. He says, "The physical expression of our approval is of great importance. We affirm what a person is and we appreciate what a person does, but this assurance must be given in more than words. Affection, the nonverbal communication of closeness, touching, and stroking, is among the most important experiences we share with one another." A young woman came to talk with me about a marriage problem. As the details spilled out, I listened to a tragic confession of a wife's unfaithfulness and consistent promiscuity. Later, we dug deeper and deeper into the past years, trying to uncover the roots of a sexual behavior pattern which was almost as much an addiction as alcoholism. We finally came to her memories of her father. "Did you and your father enjoy a close relationship?" I asked. "I cannot remember a time when my father so much as touched me," she responded. "In fact, until I was a teenager and started going out with boys, I don't remember a time when I was touched affectionately by any man." The writer says, "I think we reached a root cause of her present problem. Research reveals that girls who enter into promiscuous sexual relationships at an early age are almost always come from homes where fathers have been unaffectionate and have failed to meet the need in their young daughters to be touched and physically affirmed." Now, why do we stop doing that? We don't seem to have much problem with it when they're little. But at some point, I'm not sure what happens. I could develop theories about it, but I'm not sure what happens. I think maybe there is within a father the sense that, well, now that she's past puberty, she looks like a woman. I know she's not really a woman yet, but she looks like a woman. Maybe I shouldn't be touching her. when it may be that the thing she needs, or among the things she needs most from you, is just for you to grab her and hug her, maybe on a regular basis. It's easy to forget to do that type of thing, but she may need it. And since she's not here, I'm using my daughter in ways that she might not appreciate, but she's not here to protest. So I can remember when she was a teenager, we'd maybe be standing out in the lobby here. There were times, and I don't know why she did this, I don't think I ever asked, but she would just come over and stand real close to me. And when she did that, I'd reach out and either put my arm around her or give her a hug or whatever. She didn't ask for it verbally, but it seemed like she was asking for it with her proximity. At least that's the way I took it. I don't know that she and I have ever discussed that. Now that I'm reminding myself of it, I would like to ask her, do you remember doing that? Why'd you do that? To see what she'd have to say. But it impressed me at the time that she came and stood real close to me that way. I don't think that they outgrow the need for this from their fathers, even when they're married and have children of their own. In fact, I feel like I have evidence that they don't outgrow the need for this. I think our grandchildren need this. Granddaughters in particular may need this, although grandsons need it. I just think the fathers need to hug lots of people. If you need to make yourself a note to remind yourself to do that, it might not be an unwise idea to do that. I find that I don't mind hugging. I kind of like it, but I just don't think of it. I don't remember it. Actually, maybe I know why I don't think of it. I don't know. I don't want to get all weird on you here, but we're just here with friends tonight. And I was saying something like this to somebody not long ago privately, because I think there's something to it. And it has to do with 19th century American men. In other words, men who were born in the 19th century. Both my grandfathers were born in the 19th century. And I can't even express to you my profound respect for both of those men. And for their generation, those are the guys that really built this country. But to do it, they had to be so tough and strong that a lot of them got the impression that it would show weakness if you ever expressed the kind of affection that I'm talking about here. These guys were not huggers. And if you tried to hug one of them, it was like hugging a rock or a tree. Just, okay, I'm waiting for you to quit that, you know. They couldn't even tell you, those guys couldn't even tell you they loved you. Do you know that? I knew they loved me, but they couldn't say it. The closest they could get is, we love you. Couldn't say, I love you. That's just too personal. And I can understand it because I was raised around it for the first X number of years of my life. I can understand it. But I think it influenced me, and I think it influenced a lot of my generation of men. I know it influenced my dad's generation. These old guys, as wonderful as they were, it was hard for them to even express appreciation. I can talk about people because everybody's dead. My mother told me one time, my dad never told me this, but my mother told me that my dad's father never one time in life ever told him that he did a good job at anything and never told him that he loved him. Isn't that? I mean, by today's standards, that's just weird. But by the standards back at that time, that was the way you did. Well, he knows I love him, I feed him. You know, that type of thing. It's just a different mindset. And we're only a couple generations away from that now. Maybe that's why it's hard to remember to even hug your wife sometimes. It's not that I don't want to. I actually enjoy hugging my wife, but sometimes I get busy, I just forget it. I'm focusing on something else. Here's the thing about men. Men are built to focus. Women can multitask. Men aren't as good at it. I mean, I've been in so many homes where there's a mother with a baby in one arm, she's stirring a dish with another, and she's got a phone right here to have a conversation and doing something with her foot, like a one-man band. Men aren't near as good at multitasking. Women can scatter their concentration. Men are built, apparently, to focus on one thing. And that's one reason that sometimes they focus on career. It's immediately rewarding to them. home is messier for all kinds of reasons. But it's easy to focus on the career. And the old line used to be when I was growing up, I've heard many men say, as when I was growing up, I don't think they say it anymore, but the idea used to be that their mother will raise the children, I'm making a living, as though his job ended at making a living. Well, the Bible never teaches that. In fact, it teaches just the opposite of that. And it's crucially important for us to remember that. The next thing I want to talk about here is in verse 8. The being affectionately desirous of you, that was my first point there. And the next phrase is, we were willing to have imparted unto you. There is, from a father to his children, an imparting of life. Your children want their lives to be marked by your life if you're their father. We're talking about an etching in their life that no mother can ever erase. A permanent etching. And imparting a series of values. By watching you, your child learns what's really important in life. Not as much by listening to what you say is important. You know, you can fool yourself in believing that something is the most important thing to you in life when it really isn't. You can fool yourself, but good luck fooling your kids about it. Because they've got that scrutiny going on every day, and they know what's important to you. Whether you even know it or not, they know what's most important to you. I thought you were going to ring the buzzer already. Thank you, Mike. By watching you, they learn what's really the most important thing in your life. And by seeing what's important to you, they learn what ought to be important to them. So an imparting of life means the values of life, how you set your priorities. From the father, they learn the ability to make decisions and stick with them. They learn how to take risks to their advantage. They learn how to make good decisions. They learn the importance of and the place in life of a strong sense of humor. Often they learn that most from their father. They learn how to handle stress from their father. The father may do it well or not well, but the children tend to learn to do it the way the father did, the handling of the stress. Often from a father, they'll learn how to handle finances. They need to learn how to handle finances from somebody, preferably father or mother, and often it is the father. From their father, they learn how to integrate the whole scene of life, not just the religious scene, but all of life, and how the religious scene fits in with the rest of life. They develop an understanding of this, and they take on, in many or most cases, they'll take on the thinking of the father with regard to this. Verse 8 says, because you were dear to us, because you were so dear to us, that's why I wanted to impart life to you, says Paul. When you see the value of making that kind of a deposit, then you will impart life to your children. And you help your children discover how valuable they themselves are. One reason I never used LSD, and you know, this is a kind of a cultural reference in a way, and it's almost impossible to describe how things were 50 years ago on college campuses. There was LSD everywhere. It was very common to use it, but sometimes people didn't make it through the trip very well. So there was a risk to it. Everybody knew there was a risk. But I had people all around me using LSD. One reason I did not use LSD is because I thought I had some value. And I don't know if I could even put that into words very well, but I thought that I had some value, and I didn't want to take that kind of a risk with it. Now, why did I think I had some value? Somebody gave me that impression. My parents. It must have come from my parents, primarily. I believe that I had some value, so I didn't tinker with LSD. I had a father who did not drink or smoke. I was at a friend's house one time in high school, and my friend's father, to the embarrassment of my friend's father was dead drunk. And he was saying all kind of things about this, that, and the other thing. My friend was embarrassed, so we went in my friend's bedroom, and he lit up a joint of marijuana. I didn't join in with that, because my friend said, well, if he can drink like that, then I can use weed. Well, I couldn't say that about my dad. There was nothing to react against with regard to him saying one thing and doing another. So I didn't do that either. I still loved my friend. I still hung out with my friend, but I just didn't engage with that with him. Somewhere, somebody had told me that I had some value, so I don't know how to explain all of that, but I think it's just almost by osmosis, that there's a purpose for your life. God has created you to accomplish something, so you need to prepare yourself to get out there and do it. Also, in verse 9, Paul says, you remember, brethren, our labor and travail, for laboring night and day, because we would not be chargeable to any of you, we preached unto you the gospel of Christ. A father sets an example of hard work and unselfishness. Now, this comes from the mother as well, but I think the father is the main leader here. Men are built, normal men, are built to be workhorses. A woman gets worn down a little easier than a man, generally speaking. They are the weaker gender physically and not mentally, but physically there is a little more of a weakness there, generally speaking. This is obviously this isn't true in every family, but generally speaking, a woman's health suffers more if she gets out there and hits the ball hard every day and doesn't take a break. I think a man is the one who's built to be the workhorse. A man is the one who sets the strongest example of hard work and unselfishness. And a guy's children get their attitude about work from their father primarily. They will have feelings regarding work that are based on what was imprinted on them by their father. It's always been a sad thing to me that, and I don't know, I guess it's stopping time, but did he push it? I don't know. I got to stop it here a minute. I'll just finish this one thing. It's a sad thing to me that so many people are unhappy in their jobs, and I don't know of anything that I can do about it at this point. But I do think we need to encourage our young people to train themselves and prepare themselves for something that they can enjoy while they're making a living, rather than get into something just by chance and have to do that all their life long because now I've got a family to support and I can't make any changes. Even that's not usually as true as people think it is, but I'm sorry to see so many people dissatisfied with their job. I love to see people who enjoy their work, because if you're dissatisfied with your job, you can't hide that from your children. They're going to know that. And then your child imbibes or tends to imbibe the same spirit toward work as you have. We all need to try to turn our work into something of a learning experience that we can enjoy rather than just a drag. And I got more to say about fathers, but some things beyond that too about children, but I'm sure the class doesn't seem as short to you as it does to me. Thank you for bearing with me. I don't know what gets into me sometimes. And rather than let somebody spill this and make a mess, I'll just take it with me. Thank you.